Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where you'll receive a boost of inspiration, practical advice, and tools to maximize your success and personal happiness. And that's not all. You'll also get plenty of guidance on how you can use your gifts, talents, and compassion to contribute towards making the world a better place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a preview of what's in store and to also receive a free ebook. To sign up, simply visit www.thedreamcatch.com. Now it's my pleasure to introduce you to the host of the Dreamcatcher Podcast, Celine Chinoy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, the place where your dreams can find a voice. While Buddhism is seen as a major global religion, Buddhist ideas, philosophies, and practice have long been a source of inspiration for people of other faiths. That's because it's more of a spiritual tradition that educates us on how to live well and to find inner peace. And today, I'm going to be speaking with one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet about Buddhism, Robert Thurman. Robert Thurman is a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University, as well as co-founder and president of Tibet House U.S. Menla, in service of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He was named by the New York Times the leading American expert on Tibetan Buddhism and was awarded the prestigious Padma Shri Award in 2020 for his help in recovering India's ancient Buddhist heritage. Time magazine chose him as one of the 25 most influential Americans in 1997. In this interview, we're going to be discussing some of the main concepts covered in Robert Thurman's new book, Wisdom is Bliss, Four Friendly Fun Facts That Can Change Your Life. He'll offer his insight into Buddhist principles such as nirvana, karma, and the practice of mindfulness, and how we can apply them in our everyday life. If you like what you heard, please don't forget to like, rate, share, and subscribe to this podcast. Thanks. Hello, Robert. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Celine. I'm so happy to see you, actually.
I'm happy to see you, too. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's truly an honor to have you here with us today.
Well, that's awfully nice. I don't think it's an honor. Come on, it's just fun. It should be fun, though.
It should be fun. Yes, yes.
So that's true. That's true. The title of my new book, Wisdom is Bliss.
Exactly.
Have you read it? Did you have time to read it?
I did have a chance to read it. Oh, yes, wow. I did.
I'm so excited about that.
Yes. You know,
when someone has read it and they ask questions and then I have to clarify or I see something, I've been learning from my own book by having someone ask question about it and then seeing things in a new way that I wrote, which is funny. I've gotten actually to like this book, sometimes I've written books where I never am satisfied, but finally, you know, the deadline comes, you have to like, oh, and then I think, oh, I should have done the other or this, but this one I'm really liking.
Yeah. And it was a very clear framework that you use, which really made it easy for readers like me to understand. There are certain things that really that I really resonated with, and I'm sure that listeners would really like to know more about. So, yeah, I mean, sure. I want to start out by asking you about something that I heard you say in an interview. You said that your aim in writing this book was to make the core values and perspectives of Buddhism more accessible to people.
Yes,
could you tell us more about that and how you were able to accomplish that through this book?
Well, because I was focusing, actually, my deeper aim, which I also say all the time about the book, is I feel that people are scared of reality. In general, the Eastern, Western, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, whatever it is, the way that the teachings of the great founders, who I feel were enlightened beings, who were in touch with the deepest nature of reality, which was the compassion and love, whether they said of God or whether they said of reality, it doesn't matter because it was basically that the deep energy of the universe, the life energy of the universe is love, actually. And that's what Buddha's message was and is and remains, and why he has been globally popular for so long as one of the three big global traditions, which I think share that message, actually, all three. I think, what I say about the three big ones is that, you know, Buddhism, historically, in historic sequence, about 500-600 years after each other, Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam are the three ones that sort of spread widely beyond a particular nation, you know, beyond a particular sort of clan or nation, you could say. You know, Hinduism is pretty big because India's population is so huge, mm-hmm. but sort of it's meant to only, they didn't really want to have other people be Hindus, you know. Other people were outside. Some modern teachers, like Vedanta teachers, they think it's good to meditate. But you sort of have to be born Indian to be a Hindu, you know. Like you have to be born Jewish to be Jewish, you know. And Chinese is Confucius, that's for Chinese. So, mm-hmm. but Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam sort of were universal in their appeal. And I think the true figure for each is about 1.5 billion. I think that people will say that Buddhism is only 700 million or something. But that's because China, they don't really allow people to register, you could say.
Oh,
they're
communists,
don't. You know.
Okay.
They're communists, right? So, yeah. I mean, there are people who say, well, I'm really Buddhist or I'm really Christian or I'm really Muslim in China, but in a way, it's not allowed.
Right.
And they're cracking down nowadays in a bad way, on like the Uyghurs, you know, the terrible thing going on with the Uyghur Muslims, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then the Tibetans and Mongolians have been suffering for their culture, because China wants everyone to have just one culture, which is their communist Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm.
Even they say they're 2,000 years of culture, but they were not communists. Only 50, 60 years they've been communists, you know. And that's not really Chinese, even. That comes from Karl Marx, you know. So anyway, never mind. But my point is, yes. So I feel that, however, even though Christ and Buddha and Muhammad, and, you know, may he be praised, may he be,
Alhamdulillah.
You know, even though the three of them were just teaching the love of the universe, basically, two out of three saying that's God, but, you know, on a basis of, well, God is love, you know, Al-Rahim, you know, Allah Al-Rahim, in the case of Islam, and St. John, you know, God is love. And but then later, people organize these things, I think, particularly political leaders. And they push the high priests into their way of seeing. And they push into sort of more scaring people. And people don't know, they're worried maybe God will send them to hell or something. Or maybe they will, or they maybe, you know, maybe reality really is some sort of horrible thing. Mm-hmm. And it's only a few of us little humans on the planet, like the way the materialists think. Few of us little humans here. And, oh, there's no other human beings anywhere. Any place, and then the animals all want to eat us, and the planet is blowing up, and it's not well designed, the planet. We have to fix it up and have parking lots instead of fields, you know. So basically, people are frightened and terrorized in order to make them manageable and obedient to political authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And so
they weaponized.
Yeah, they used the teachers who taught freedom.
Uh-huh.
And love of reality, and that reality mm-hmm. loves you so you can be secure to be loving in your life and not violent and domineering in your life. Mm-hmm. And they weaponize that to use it as a dominating thing. And so, and even people misunderstand Buddha's teaching as being that, oh, yeah, it's all suffering, so you just better get used to suffering. And, that, and well, maybe a few people can leave the world and go to Nirvana, which is outside some other place, you know. It's like,
yes. Neverland.
Beyond Alpha Centauri or something, you know.
Yes.
In other words, which is completely wrong, you know. He never, Buddha, as Dalai Lama would say, Buddha would never have mentioned the prevalence of suffering for a self-centered person if it wasn't that a self-centered person can become other-centered and loving and altruistic and then be really happy in this world, the way the world is, because Nirvana really is basically, the doorway to Nirvana is everywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you find love in the world, that's Nirvana. You know,
and I'm sure that's a question you get asked very often. Like, Norbert, how do I achieve Nirvana? How do I get there? Yes, and yes, you actually say in the book that the way to reach Nirvana is by facing reality. So I find that pretty interesting. Like, you've said a lot about it in the book, but I'd love to hear you say it here. Like, mean, is facing reality the way, or?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, even the, you know, the Buddhists have the famous, the Tibetan Buddhists in particular, they have the famous so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead with instructions for the after-death situation. And because from the beginning, even in India in Buddha's time, there were those who were like modern atheist materialists who pretended that they knew that we wouldn't exist at all after death. And so it was the easy solution. Just grit your teeth and let go, and then you'll just be unconscious, basically asleep permanently. And you'll never wake up again, and you won't know that you were ever awake, so you won't miss being awake. So in a way, they're teaching a kind of fake nirvana of being anesthetized eternally, so nothing to fear, if you will, you know, and also no consequence for how you behaved. You could be as nasty as you could be a nasty ruler, president or king or prime minister or sheikh, and totally torment your own people and enslave them, etc. And there would be no consequence to you for having acted so badly, you know, and killed people and things, and without caring. And but of course, that's fake, because it has been discovered by me, actually, as it was by Buddha, ancient time, that newsflash, there's no such thing as nothing. So it's not a place waiting for you, and no something ever can become nothing. And that's the law of reality, of relativity. You know? Mm-hmm. So for them to have a blind faith that they're going to be nothing, these materialists, you know, modern materialists, is much more crazy than faith in God or faith in any particular other thing, that at least somebody had, you know, Moses talked to a burning bush, you know, and Muhammad mm-hmm. had dictation from Gabriel on orders from Allah, and so on, you know. So, you know, he was a medium, a channel, you know, as a prophet, you know. So at least somebody was talking to them, so that somebody's there. But nothing is not there. So to believe that you're going there is psychotic, actually. It's really bad. And that's, I think, why this modern technological culture, for all its marvels, you know, which I appreciate, of course, the marvels. Even here we are talking like we're in the same room together.
I know, right?
Thousands of miles apart. I think that's just wonderful. And I personally love, I mean, I don't necessarily love all the way they manage it, the business Facebook, but I love the reality of Zoom and Facebook and whatever it is that we kind of having to cope. A lot of people, I think, are threatened by it, but we're sort of coping with the global reality so that we're related to everybody who in ancient days, they were sort of aliens, you know, like they weren't really human, you know, like for a pink person, a Chinese was a yellow person was, there's no white people. That's one of my new theories. They're only pink people. So I'm sending letters to the white supremacists in America that they should change their name to pink supremacists. And that might calm them down. You know, that's my theory. They're all pinks in search of a tan, you know, type of thing. But anyway, I lose the track, you know. So the thing is that what Buddha discovered is that the reality of life is nirvana. And what nirvana is not nothing. You know, what it is an infinite life force, an infinite loving energy, love being, sharing itself, giving itself to others is what love means. You know, if you have happiness when you love someone, you want them to have the same happiness, you know. And so love means, it's defined in ancient Sanskrit psychology, Indian psychology being the greatest on the world, really still, I think. It discovered that what love means is the wish for the beloved to be happy. You know, it mixes with desire, you know, and lust even. In our English use, eros does, you know.
Yes.
And then we say eros and agape, and agape is sort of the selfless one in Greek, you know. Yeah. But actually, in a way, you know, the selfishness, it just distorts the wish for happiness, where it's only my own happiness and therefore can be harmful to the beloved. And that's not the love as defined, you know. Mm-hmm. But love as defined, including all forms of it, are basically altruistic in Buddha's view. And I think in Muhammad's and in Jesus, and actually in all the great prophets and saints in history. And because they sort of all went through a kind of dark night of the soul. You know, they went through a very difficult period where they sort of faced and embraced death, you could say. Really, they did. Mm-hmm. All great, such great people. And then to their amazement, they discovered that death is not nothing. Death is not torture or torment. Death, once you're past what it is where your own connection to the life force becomes too big for your body to manage. And that because you're too old or you're too sick or you had an accident and it was broken in some way. And so your body can no longer be a viable channel for the basic energy of life, which is the place you fall when you die. So what happens, you know, which they show in the book of so-called Book of the Dead, which is a wrong title. The real title is The Book of Natural Liberation or Natural Freedom.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
By learning about it in the between state, in the between death and rebirth state, that is to say the afterlife. Mm-hmm.
Because there is a Book of the Dead in ancient Egyptian
that's right.
culture.
That's
so I got a little bit mixed up when I read that in the book. I'm like,
exactly.
Are they related?
Yeah, well, in a way they're related because the Book of the Dead in Egypt, and who knows if that was the original Egyptian title, actually, because of course what it was showing was that the pharaohs and the sort of upper people who were sort of divinized in the Egyptian system, that they are not gone just because they left their body and they're in a boat on the Nile, you know, eating halva, honey halva or something, you know, they're having a good time. So actually they're not dead. You know, so I admit that may not have been their title, actually. It may have been the Buddha, the Book of the Passage to the New Life or to the Eternal Life or something. It might have been some book like that. Because the Tibetan book is natural liberation by the nature of the reality, the natural liberation, by learning what is that thing in the between state. And the way they describe it is when you first really disconnect from the body, is when you find that you are kind of like, in communion, at least, if not union, with an infinite life force, you know, which is Allah al-Rahim in the Islamic terminology, is a merciful or loving God in the positive Christian terminology. And then that's nirvana, which is the essence of any divine loving being, as far as Buddha goes.
So is that a state of being in touch with that universal love that you're speaking about? Is that what nirvana is, essentially?
Yeah, it is. That, yeah, nirvana is where you can embrace the vastness of that.
So the vastness.
The problem for the normal person who passes out of the body, because the body can't handle the force of the loving plenum, you know, the plenitude of energy that exists in the universe for anyone to get whatever they need from, like a wish-fulfilling jewel, you know. But people can't handle because they're used to being in a limited embodiment, and then they're beyond the guardian wall, or beyond this, there's dangerous, there's germs, micro dangers, there's macro dangers, lions and tigers and enemies and so on. And so there's all this, and time is a kind of danger because then they grow old or they get sick.
Mm-hmm.
So they're used to worrying about being too expanded or too open. And what this is a state of complete openness, because the loving universe is open to whatever anybody needs.
That's so it's a state of consciousness. Because, okay, I've heard that some people can reach this state apparently by taking drugs, and I'm not advocating the use of certain drugs, but you know, a lot of people think, like the hippies and stuff, that you can reach that nirvana-like state when you are in an altered state of consciousness. Well, so I just want to clarify,
sure, I'm happy to clarify it. In a way, yes and no is the idea. The yes part of it is that some of the, especially what are called the psychedelic.
Psychedelic, that's it.
Or there was a great term coined by a religion professor in America called Houston Smith. He called them entheogenic, you know, in other words, generating a divine kind of awareness. But nobody, set responsible anyway, ever claimed that you would actually be able to reach nirvana just by chemical change. However, What does happen is one's normal conceptual framework, where one has been frightened by authorities into feeling that reality is very dangerous, and so you have to be very closed up and very, you know, armored, you know, and you can't be open to people because you have to just look out for yourself because it's too dangerous and people are really bad and all this, you know, they have to be controlled by police, And that whole conceptual structure, which everyone tends to be brainwashed by in their culture, I mean, from childhood, I mean, not necessarily by a fascist regime, but from childhood, because of the distortion of the teachings of the great founders. And what can happen with those chemicals or plants, which the tribal people have used since they...
Yes, they have. Yeah, I've heard.
You know, that temporarily gets shattered. And so... you kind of face the world without presupposition. And then what happens is people see, gee whiz, that flower that I used to say, when I looked at it, that rose, oh yeah, that's a rose. And then I looked away to the next thing because I labeled it and bam, it was captured by my concept. And then I paid no attention to it. So when my concept doesn't work and I'm sort of staring at the rose, oh, there's all kinds of other dimensions in that rose, the beauty of it suddenly, which is like a poet's view where it's sort of indescribable beauty, will sort of hit a person. So usually, sometimes some people who are unguided will actually get even more scared than usual, actually, because they when they think they can't recognize things, they think of them some really bad thing will happen to them. If they're particularly self-centered and very paranoid, they will have a terrible time unless they're guided well, you know, and encouraged not to feel, you know, to feel safe. Do you know what I mean? So in that sense, it can open a door that can make one think maybe there is such a thing as another way of being that is totally enlightened and open, which is a more beautiful way of being and more loving and more altruistic and therefore more receptive and people like it more popular, et cetera, you know, because you're loving and kind to others and you're empathetic with them and you're other regarding to them. And so the idea is that it can be the useful of by shattering temporarily the normal habitual way of seeing where there's no nirvana, you know, like there's no such thing.
Like the ego, does the ego get dissolved and do you lose those mental constructs?
But the ego is still there. It doesn't destroy the ego. Mm-hmm. And actually enlightenment doesn't destroy it either. It just
makes the ego
a little more secure where it doesn't need to feel it dominate and control everything because it's so scared of everything. In other words, a kind of neurotic self-centeredness that is always very crippling to a person. As you know, people who are highly self-centered, they are among the most unhappy people that you know because they're always evaluating what's ever happening to them by saying, is this for me? Is it enough for me? Do I have enough or could I have it better?
Don't they call that the hungry ghosts?
They do. Extreme level. Well, that's a non-human way of being. So human can almost, because see, the key thing about humans from Buddhist zoology, you could say, because I'm presenting Buddha as a scientist more than a prophet, you know, because he's challenging the way that Hinduism, which was a theistic religion of its own way, Hinduism was structuring the world to make people scared and dominatable, you know, in the caste system and so on, you know, and put in their place. And so the king could manage them without them demanding too much freedom, you know, and that's the way the world was. So Buddha challenged that with facts, with reality, with science, you know, with the direct experience, you know, not just with some theory, you know. And science of mind, you could say science of soul science or spiritual science, just as the great Sufis like Ibn Arabi, and these kind of people, you know, Attar, you know, Rabia of Basra,
Rumi.
You know, Rumi, yes. This is just as they did. They were people who had experience of, they sort of really entered through the Quran and through the Prophet, alhamdulillah. They entered the reality that, in fact, he was inspired by, you know, which they call Allah, you know, which I don't know Arabic, but I do know that La is a different pronunciation, means is a negation.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it means no. La literally means no.
So although Allah means God, but in a way you could read Allah, Al, which is a like the no.
Yes.
You could read it like that. So la ilaha illallah, you know, la la thing is a negation. You know, Allah, the no. But I know it's pronounced in a different way and so on. So I'm not making any kind of, you know, a sacrilegious thing. But yes. But that's beautiful in a way. And it is the ancient Judaic thing that Muhammad was aligned with, you mm-hmm. know, which is that the Judaic thing being that you can't pronounce the name of the divine because it's so much bigger than anything you can conceive. Mm-hmm. And when a human being names something, then they think they own it and they can control it. Do you know what I mean? Rather than they have to give themselves and open themselves to the force of it, you know, and just be one with it through faith. Do you know what I'm saying? Which is like a Buddhist meditation of reaching openness, you know, freedom, you know, and realizing that loving freedom of the universe, you know. But anyway, so which they can call, they have a godlike word for that, but they can also just call it reality, you know. So they're mm-hmm. not stuck on any particular word. And therefore, it fits very well with the Judaic, the Abrahamic, let's call it, traditions, if properly understood, and not manipulated by warlords to make people feel that I can fight because God enables me to kill these people. That's really not cool. It's time in history, I think, to really more openly, rather than just some secret people, some hidden Sufi or some hidden imam someplace or some hidden somebody, you know, because the authorities are not going to tolerate anyone who teaches freedom and openness and generosity and love and not violent domination. The authorities never want that. They want their armies. They want their conquests and they want their, and also the patriarchy wants to dominate the women and, you know, who are the more peaceful one among the humans, you know? And so it's time where these hidden mystic, what are called mystic, as you know, mystic only means in Greek, mystikos only means hidden. It doesn't mean it's some weird thing that's irrational. It's actually more rational and more experiential than the contorted thing of making the beauty of this planet and of reality and of this incredible creation that we live in, making it something frightening where we have to burn oil all the time and we have to like make concrete, you know, get rid of all the plants which might be, infect us. It's like, meanwhile, the plants are giving us energy, oxygen, you know. And so, we're, in fact, therefore, we're destroying it by being scared of it.
Robert, like in our world, you know, which has become increasingly materialistic and there's been more focus on the self, how can people, you know, move towards kindness and engaging in acts of altruism? Like how can the teachings from Buddhism help people get into
if they're seen, you see, that's my point. But if they're seen as from Buddhism, they will not reach a lot of people because immediately the category will be, oh, that's a weird religion of some other people. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
My religion is something other than that. So that will not reach. And there's no need to. Like the Dalai Lama, you know, when he comes to the West, or Europe, or Japan, or anywhere, or even in India, which is really a predominantly Hindu Muslim country. When he goes to any other place like that, he says, it's too late in history to go around acting like we have the sole and only truth, you know, and everybody else has to be like us and they have to adopt our slogans and our credos. And instead of that, learn from each other what we know about the soul, about the mind, about the heart, not just the brain, you know, and even embrace the atheists, actually, who...
those who don't believe in a soul.
He considers the fourth 1.5 billion religion on the planet to be the atheist. And that's a religion. And, you know, the communists, they, you know, Marx, you know, oh, yeah, it's better, we better not... And because, in a way, they're reacting against the corporate behavior of the religions, you know. By saying that, in a way, but they're not really facing up to the fact that they are acting corporate and like fanatics, like a religion of atheism. I mean, their ideology is a kind of religion, for sure, and they'll kill for it.
I actually, I actually had the opportunity to interview a humanist, and it was interesting to hear his take on it. And that, you know, really, they too, the roots of humanism is altruism and doing good in the world, even though they don't have a belief in divinity and things like that. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah,
exactly. And I don't blame them in their Western enlightenment, which I think is very similar to the Buddhist one. Buddha's one, I should say not Buddhist. Buddha. Actually, when Buddha had it, there were no Buddhists. He was just teaching people. You know, there was no such thing as Buddhism, you know, and he was rebelling against the domineering aspect in Vedism at the time. You know? And you know, I don't blame them for dropping God in Europe in that 18th century time. 17th century, etc., because what God was behaving like to them, as interpreted by the Inquisition type of thing, was really suppressive, horrible.
It was.
You know, like you know, burning at the stake Giordano Bruno. You know, silencing Galileo. You can't look and see what you see in front of you because you have to adopt some slogan that if you don't repeat, we kill you. You know, and so to stop being afraid, they came up with this fake out, which is you just won't exist. So you know.
So it was a reaction. It was a reaction to the oppressive measures.
The point is, no one can torture you if you're just nothing, right? Whereas in hell, Dante's hell, you know, even purgatory, you're getting tortured or whatever. Although, as long as there was purgatory, there was some hope. And when some of them don't allow even purgatory. And we can't afford that on the planet now.
We really can't.
We have to all get back to what the original teachers taught. And we have to actually see, you know, love your enemy as scientifically more valuable. Why is that actually not an unrealistic thing? You know, why is it realistic is the point. Well, why is your enemy an enemy? Because your enemy is unhappy.
Because they did something wrong.
They think you're in the way of their happiness.
Yeah.
If they get rid of you, they will be happy. Actually, they discover once they get rid of you that it doesn't make them happy. Then they have to find someone else to get rid of. So it makes them more unhappy, actually, because they got rid of you. And you might have been able to tell them a joke or something, you know, which they didn't have a chance to listen to because they killed you. And so, but if you love the enemy, meaning wish the enemy to be happy, and if the enemy gets really happy, why are they going to bother to chase around after you? Do you know what I mean? They're going to have a good life.
What if we're talking about murderers or like someone like Hitler? I mean,
Hitler was just frustrated because he wanted to get into the famous art school in Munich because he wanted to be an artist, and they kicked him out. And then he went off to the war, and he got
he still killed a lot of innocent people. So in such situations, how can people find it in their heart to forgive?
Well, in the case of Hitler, my point is, you know, Gandhi outraged Churchill when he went to England in the 30s. And he said, guys, you have to resist Hitler nonviolently. And that will then give
you... I read about that,
Right? And then Churchill was outraged, and the English press got all excited. And then they said, how can you be like that? You mean just surrender to him? He says, no. Resisting nonviolently means that you don't cooperate with him and his people, but you don't violently attack him back. And the point is that takes huge courage because he's going to kill a bunch of you. How first, before that, his own troops stop obeying his insane orders because they realize there is no enemy out here trying to attack us. They are standing there saying, look, we'll be happy to get along with you. We like Mozart and Beethoven, and we like German cooking and schnugels and kugels. We like that, but we're not gonna fight with you. And your guy who's telling you to fight with us is crazy, and you shouldn't get your life ruined like that. You know what I'm saying? And then they're going to kill a bunch of you. Sure. But then how many million are they going to kill when you fight? That they're going to kill. And furthermore, so my recommendation is, if you had the ability and the understanding to give your life without violence, than to be willing to, then you won't give as many lives, I predict, and you will also change Germany very much more quickly without destroying it. And Hitler will be, you know, voted out by his own people or marched out or whatever it is, however they have to get rid of him. And he will, you know, he only is in there by pumping up their fear. You know, he was like Trumpist, but just the same. He read Mein Kampf as a child. His father was a Nazi. And they try to use immigration and anti-women stuff to pump up fear. It's a method. And if they have media to brainwash people, they succeed. Mm-hmm. And Germany was impoverished by a bad treaty put up at the end of World War I, where Clemenceau and Lloyd George broke Wilson's promise to the Kaiser that they would be merciful with an honorable peace. And instead, they ripped him off, and they ripped Germany's economy off totally. So they were really impoverished badly. And then that fear thing will take among the population. And we're seeing it. We were having a near miss here in the U.S. just now. Right now, it's a near miss. We're at a near miss. Fortunately, we're in a miss, but it's near. That's still going on. So my point is that was quite brilliant, actually, and it was actually practical. And there are people who are aware of that. And after all, haven't we really? Who's won a war lately? Anybody who's won any wars lately? No. It's not only Afghanistan, Vietnam, wherever it is. And maybe the Israelis think they won something because they have their wall and they have like their nukes and all this stuff. But what have they won? Everybody hates them.
Yeah, I think it depends, Robert, on how you define winning. Like people, they interpret the word winning in different ways, you know?
Yeah, well, they do. There's a short-term winning. And
there's a short-term win, yes.
Yeah, but now,
at another person's expense.
What the mother,
basically.
what Mrs. God is telling us, Mother Earth, is that our short-term way of living is unsustainable, and we're That's all going to be that our very nest, our planet, our home, will be uninhabitable in a short time. And that's why Jeff Bezos and Branson and these guys, they're heading for Mars. You know, they've given up.
Plan B. You know,
they're smart enough as scientific and economically to recognize that the way we're going is where Greta Thunberg says we're going. She is a prophet just now, a correct one. And she says, you are destroying your own future and our future, especially we younger people. And so it's become evident war is no longer viable. And it doesn't take Gandhi or Buddhism or anybody. Nobody wins them. And furthermore, when people live in a militaristic way in their internal society, and then they'll be in a police state inevitably, because they will not want to, the mothers will not want to give their sons to stupid, useless wars that nobody wins. But they'll have to be coerced to do it. And then that means the quality of life that you won sucks. And furthermore, it's short term because you're depleting the soil, you're poisoning the air, polluting the water. Look at, it can't be managed, you know.
And that has karmic consequences, right? When you do such things.
Yeah. Karma just means causality. Do you know what I mean? Right. Karma is not a mystical force in the reality. It's just causality, you know. It's like you're digging your own grave.
Pretty much, yes.
When you try to say, I'm winning because I have like 100 generators and 5,000 barrels of oil here, and I have guns and I have booby traps and mines all around my land, et cetera. Nobody can come, and I've got like 100 years worth of food because I'll only live another 20. And then I think foolishly I'll be nothing. But actually, that's all unviable. You know? Anyway, so if we look scientifically, but let's come down just to a more simple thing, you know, what's called the equal exchange of self and other. When are you happy in life? When you're happy, like whatever, I don't know what religion is your religion, but you know, I'm
born Hindu, but I call myself spiritual.
Right. Well, Hindu has its own Christmases, right? It has holy, it has whatever, it has where people throw color lights on each other, or Diwali. They have like where they give gifts to each other, right?
That's right.
Everybody, every culture has Hanukkah for the Jews, and then Eid, I guess, for the Muslims. Everybody
and the Chinese New Year for Taoism?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So everybody has Christmas, right? But everybody knows in every family, when you get a gift, the smart people in your family give you the receipt so you can exchange it if you're not satisfied.
Isn't that against gift-giving etiquette?
Well, a little, but you know, when families say, well, they do, or they don't give it, but they mention, by the way, if it doesn't work, doesn't fit, if it doesn't fit yeah. or whatever, you can exchange. I kept it. So the only people who really love what they get are the kids who are not thinking to compare it. And they're just thrilled to have it. And it's just amazing. And then they really hug you. Oh, thank you so much. And they don't, you know, unless they've been watching a commercial about a better toy too much, if their parents don't.
I was just going to say, if they had something specific in mind, and they'd be disappointed they get something else.
And then you find out. And my point is, so when is it that you stop being happy? It's when you stop to think, how happy am I? In other words, when you evaluate your own situation, you're always dissatisfied.
Yeah, and when you're always comparing yourself, you know? Keeping up with the Joneses, as they say.
Exactly. Yeah. Then look at the divorce rate in the secular cultures.
Yes.
It's huge. It's very like practically high. It's just like a party, the marriage that it met last. Well, you can count on it. And so I perform them sometimes, so I know that. And then when you are kind to another, when another person lights up because you help, if you're a doctor and you really succeed and the patient is healed and they're happy, that doctor is really happy for that moment, you know? So in fact, if you sort of, there's a special meditational method, but which is also just not a sitting thing of being in some isolated place. It can be helped by meditating. Education is a kind of meditation itself, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, watching Fox News is a kind of meditation, which then makes you afraid and freaked out and angry. You know, this kind of hate monger people on the TV.
Right. Yeah. You take that in and that can just make you That's so bitter crazy. And you see the world as such a dangerous place. Yeah. yeah.
You watch this stuff 14 hours a day because you have Fox News on with its propaganda. Mm. Goebbels, you know, Hitler would still be in power if they had such a mechanism, you know.
It's a kind of hypnosis. It's a kind of hypnosis, isn't it?
Yes, it's a kind of hypnosis. But my point is, if you're right away from the beginning, you spend your time thinking more about what other people want and need in any situation and less about what you want and need, then you'll automatically be more satisfied with whatever you have because you won't be evaluating it. Instead, you'll be thinking, oh, they need that. Well, wouldn't it be nice if I could do this and the other? And I think this is a harder practice for males. Because actually females normally do that more. You know, like the mother in the family does sort of think about dog needs to be fed, baby needs to bath, so-and-so has this problem, that problem. They more look at what the other people need more, actually. And of course, some people will think that means they're supposed to be martyrs, but isn't. That's why families hang together a little bit, because of women. You know, when one of my earlier books, Inner Revolution, that I wrote, you know, coming up, this is kind of a culminating thing now. I'm 80, or published on my 80th birthday. Wisdom is bliss. It's
like belated happy birthday.
But the earlier one was called Inner Revolution. And then I had a concept there of the cool hero, cool heroism, you know, not hot heroism, based on the idea that we all agree that someone will be ready even to give their life, pumped up on hatred in a military. You know, hatred of the enemy. I've got to save my country. You know what I mean? So I'll charge this machine gun nest, you know, like Sergeant York in World War I, all those poor people rising, running into each other's machine gun nests, you know, for no reason at all, you know, except the lords were just pissed off with each other, you know, the kings, you know, whatever, who were relatives, actually. And, you know, Cousin Willie, you know, the German Kaiser was just misbehaving. And his relatives in England were mad. And so they just, it was ridiculous, the whole thing. But the people were the cannon fodder, right? So my point is that in that book, then someone said, well, where's all the cool heroes? You mean just Gandhi, just Jesus, just Buddha, just somebody? And then I was, for a minute, I was stuck almost. And then I just thought of a family scene in my house. Mm-hmm. Either my birth family or even the present one. When the brothers, I didn't have a sister, two brothers. And We have three boys in our family, but we do fortunately have one daughter. But anyway, you know, when the brothers are about to kill each other, practically, they're really angry. You know, they'll practically come to blows. Or father and son can. You know, they can get really fierce, shouting and saying mean things to each other. Who is the one who gets in the middle and says, "No, dear, don't say that. You don't mean that. No, you mustn't hit each other. No, no." And often gets hit in between. Who is
the mother?
The mother. Exactly.
Yeah, that was certainly the case in my household.
So therefore, then I was able to say, because that popped in my mind, mm-hmm. I said to that interviewer, I said, the cool heroes are half of humanity, actually. And that's the only reason that families hang together and, mm-hmm. and the male militarized football playing, you know, punch and shove, you know, educated.
So it's that, like, feminine energy, right, that they exude that... Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but it's actually a feminine. It's not only energy; it's a feminine intelligence.
Yes.
Of seeing the bigger picture, and not getting stuck in the immediate mood and the freak out and the emotional imbalances. You know?
Yes. And that's something that Buddhism teaches. That's something that Buddhism teaches, right? To be mindful of your thoughts and your feelings.
So therefore, the male has to figure out how to pump a little more oxytocin in their nervous system and a little less cortisol and adrenal surge of, like, aggression and look at the world in a more careful way.
Yeah.
And the patriarchality of all the societies have to temper that patriarchality with the good side of the patriarch of feeding the people, bringing, helping them, protecting them, being kind to them, appreciating them, and listening to them. I know well about it because I've been slowly educated.
Yes.
Over the years.
I wanted to ask you about something. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I know you're close friends with him. And one of his main teachings that I really resonate with is the importance of educating the mind and the heart. And and he says he hopes to see schools and society focus more on inducing this heart-centered form of intelligence. And do you think that is the way to kind of get around that issue of bringing
absolutely.
In?
I totally agree with him. Therefore, you know, although maybe, you know, and one way people could say, since I was a Buddhist monk ordained by him, against
my you were one of the first ones, right? First Westerners.
Then I don't really like to be introduced like that, because then I have to say, and now I'm the first ex-monk.
Yeah.
Because I did resign my original older teacher, who had lived in America for already by that time about 10 years and knew the culture. He said, "You are not born to be a monk. You know, I know you want to be, and the monk thing in Buddhism is not like the Christian monk thing. It's more of an educational thing. It's like a way of having a lifelong scholarship in a country, because they'll give you a free lunch forever, you know. And then you're supposed to study and develop yourself. So you educate yourself lifelong. It's like a way of having a lifelong scholarship. And it isn't so much you're going to be holy or whatever, you know what I mean? And just withdraw from society. The monks are very engaged in society. And they were really called mendicants. You know, meaning they live on alms so that they don't add to the production in the society.
And that kind of lifestyle really appealed to you at the time.
Because I needed the scholarship, because I was so thrilled at studying the Buddhist science.
Yes.
The science of how the mind works, the science of the heart, how to really get the, you know, develop the good side of the heart and get rid of.
And how old were you when this happened?
20.
20,
but
okay.
They wouldn't ordain me until I was 24, because my original older teacher, my Karate Kid teacher, you could say, the old Mongolian monk, Tibetan Buddhist monk, but from Mongolian background, who lived in the U.S. since the 50s, and who knew the culture, you know, and he knew me. He was amazing. He was clairvoyant about me, and he knew I might have been a monk in many former lives in Tibet or in a country or in Mongolia, a country where that was an open, viable profession, you know, a vocation. But it wasn't really, it's not that in America. There are some Catholic monks, but this is a different kind of monk. And Catholic monks are really just barely tolerated in a Protestant ethic country, because everybody has to be productive in Protestant ethic. Right? You can't purify yourself. You just throw yourself on the mercy of God because you're a sinner to start with, Calvin and Luther, So they didn't support monasteries, basically. There are a few sort of exceptional ones, but they don't believe in that. And therefore, you have these Catholic monasteries like where Thomas Merton was, 5,000 acres and 16 buildings and 15 monks, or 25 maybe, because it's just not a possibility in this culture. So they made me wait 3 or 4 years. And then only in a couple more years after that, I realized civil rights movement was going on, the stupid and asinine, ridiculous Vietnam War was going on. My people and my peers were challenging those things. And I wanted to, and my teacher said, no, you can't do that if you're a mendicant, because a Buddhist can't interfere in American politics, because it's not part of the American thing. So you have to either go out and do that if you feel that you have to, but you can't do that while being a monk in a monastery here. So then I did have to resign, to be more activist, And that was because that's what I wanted. But then I realized the way to keep learning as I wanted would be become a professor, and then I could study and teach. And then you have to keep studying when you teach, or you're a dead teacher. And so therefore, I was able to sort of like the monastery, the university, Although I was lucky, I found a new teacher in my wife, who has been my guru of the last 55 years.
Wow.
54 years. And I learned so much.
Relationship goals.
It is really wonderful. And all thanks to her, Probably I would have lost it, because I had a lot to learn, And I have slowly learned most of it, and I'm fairly happy now. So that's the thing, right? So back on that point, therefore, it's a way of being more happy right now is to be more altruistic and compassionate. And especially in order to understand that, I harp on that a lot here, that you have to understand that being compassionate doesn't mean being namby-pamby and saying to people, oh, come and beat me up, and being a martyr. On the contrary, if you're really empathetic with other people, if you run into a local Hitler, neighborhood Hitler or something, then you can be quite tough with them as a compassionate. And actually, you can be more effective in it, like martial arts thing, because they can sense that you don't actually even though they're bad and they know they're bad, you don't hate them. You're opposing them, and you can oppose them with intelligence, with humor, with force, because you're not knotted up inside by hating and being angry. When you hate and anger, you're knotted up inside, and your judgment is very bad. What to do? You don't think of anything good to do. You just kind of do the same thing, banging your head against the wall. You don't know what to do. But if you're cool, you can figure out how to maneuver around a bad person, and they can sense when you don't actually hate them. You just want to stop what they're doing, and therefore there's a possibility they might, swerve and go after somebody else. Or you might let you escape, or whatever it is. If I think something
kind of like an animal, right? They can sense when you are not you're not a source of threat to them, right? They can feel that on an instinctual level. So it's similar, right, with human beings.
Absolutely, sure. When we all sense, we're all animals, and we all sense.
We are
we're
animals. All clairvoyant.
We're 100% clairvoyant. We sense what the other person, how they really are feeling, and whatever. And that's because the heart senses that. The mind might not, although can be trained to. One of Dalai Lama's friends is that guy called Eckhart. And he can read on the faces of people, little muscular movements.
Yes, I've heard about that. Yes.
And he can read, he's like a living lie detector. He can read people's emotions from the face. And therefore, he got to really like the Dalai Lama because he said he never met someone who was so open in the way, and by their facial expression, there was nothing, no guarding. He was just where he was. He was just right there, And there was the very relaxed face was, he was amazed about it, No kind of tension in the ear or the jaw muscle there or other places.
Almost like the Buddha, actually.
I don't have that awareness. But our subliminally, we do. It's like, and also women do. Women know on a blind date, in 5 minutes, whether it's going to be work out or not, but they're socialized to be polite and to, be self-sacrificing. So they'll sit through a boring conversation and a long dinner and hope the food is not too bad, and then sort of have a headache when they want to go home.
And they also live in the illusion. They project that fantasy that they have. So that's something that Buddhism talks about too, living in our illusions. And that's what gets in the way.
Their own intuition.
Right.
They will override their conceptual framework that they've been indoctrinated in, will cause them to override what they actually know from the heart right away. Instead of, and save themselves so much trouble. You know, they could save themselves a failed marriage or two. There, for example, if they were really followed that intuition, you know. So that's the thing. So it's actually more practical ultimately on a small plane interpersonally. It's more practical on a huge plane because militaristic place and police states suck. And you know, look at this life in the European Union. Those people are really happy, and it doesn't matter what you call it. They're plenty capitalists. They're not particularly socialist, but there's some sort of aspect of taking care of it. It's like a new deal goes on there.
Yes.
And they, you know, free healthcare, perfectly good healthcare. I was examined for a little piece of melanoma on my forehead by a lady who's a friend of a friend. I wasn't even a resident. Didn't cost me a thing. She gave me a thing and put it on there, went off, got off, you know. You know, just she gets paid by the state in some.
Where was this?
France, Paris, Paris.
Oh, France. Okay, because I know they have that in Scandinavia. I lived in Sweden for a while, and
this was in France. And
yeah.
I know people here who know that and have gone south of France and had operations that here they were bankrupting them, and then rents are reasonable mostly, and then their taxes are not that high. Gas is expensive, but. You know, then they make nice gas, sensible cars, and they're going to go totally electric very fast now. BMW, they're building huge electric factories. And Tesla is building a factory in Berlin, you know, himself, mm-hmm. you know, Elon, my hero, Elon. And actually, the other word I've recently, like, a friend of mine, a Nicaraguan lady who has helped a lot of women in refugee communities, you know, migrant communities where they've been, you know, the whole family had to leave someplace, you know. And she has the word shiro. I really like that word.
Shiro. I think Maya Angelou coined that word, actually.
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, I thought my Nicaraguan, friend thinks she coined it. And I'm sure she wouldn't misrepresent. She would give attribution. She's a journalist. Sure she would if she knew that. Good. Yeah, that happened to me. I coined a term called psychonaut instead of astronaut.
Yes.
For the Indian inner science, which is not particularly Buddhist or Hindu. It's Jain. And the Sufis, actually. It's the early Sufi. Al-Sindi is an early Sufi in India, from India. From India. And I thought I coined psychonaut. And then I found, a year or two later after I was going around, I coined psychonaut. That is Stanislaus Grof, a psychiatrist who came from Czech and lives in California. He has it in one of his books before I thought of it. But I hadn't read that book.
Yeah, you didn't know. So
I might have heard it somewhere, the zeitgeist, but he gets the credit. And so now I give attribution to him always. Look at you. You're doing Dreamscape. Or what is it?
The Dreamcatcher. The Dreamcatcher. Exactly. Yes.
The Dreamcatcher is so great. Like one of the methods of becoming more aware is to practice lucid dreaming, for example. And one of the great bonuses, even if you're not very good at it, or if you only get a little hint of it after even quite a while, some people very quickly can do that. Some people takes a lot of effort. You know, night after night, they have to remind themselves to try to wake up in the dream without waking up, you know, so they're conscious in the dream, that they are in a dream, you know. But even trying to do it gives you more freedom when you're awake. So you can be more lucidly awake because you begin to more realize in the dream, if you can be lucid in the dream, that you kind of do shape even your environment in the dream. You know, if your mood will shape how you perceive what seems to be not you. So you realize more your responsibility in the quality of your happiness or fear and suffering, you know, or relaxation and happiness. And then you start seeing it more like you're a bit more open to, well, the way I see the world is I don't have to fixate on it. Maybe there would be another dimension to what I'm experiencing. And you get a bigger picture. And it's a marvelous thing. So in doing that, you are attentive to people who are trying to think of better things and live more happily and better. So you are absolutely a practitioner of, you know, exchanging self-preoccupation for other preoccupation and living more in what they want, et cetera, and therefore ignoring more what you admit, not focusing so much on what you need and want, being more open. Of course, you still do, and you should, because you are in a way, you know, you tomorrow is other than you today. So you are, you have to have compassion for yourself, of course, to really open up more and be compassionate about others. But by being more open to thinking, well, what would I want tomorrow? Then you're less focused on what I have to have right now, you know, and that frees you. And then you're more free about it, if you follow me. So it's actually immensely practical, psychologically and scientifically, and is a way of educating oneself gradually, educating one's heart gradually, since the schools, since my university did a lousy job of that. And even they're so bent on their materialist natural science that they, funding-wise, they deplete the humanistic, you know, humanities courses, and they give more focus on the hard sciences and the social sciences, because I can get more profit by knowing that, you know. And that's a shame, you know. We need new schools.
Right.
I need a bliss universe, super bliss university.
Super bliss university, yes.
That's right.
And yeah, books like yours, is, you know,
right?
It's the beacon of light. It's what's guiding people in that direction.
And your dream catcher, like broadcast with a relax in multicolors behind you, is really great. And, you know,
oh, thank you. So that means so much to me.
Degree from super bliss university. For sure.
I'm trying my, you know, with the platform that I've been given, I'm just trying my best to spread the word.
I think it's great. You're sitting there in the middle of the world between India and the West, and you're sharing, and that you're enabling people who are trying to live the dream a little bit wherever they are, and enabling them to share and resonate with others, you know, and that's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to do. I have a lot of podcasts I try to do too.
Thank you so much, Robert. And I just want to thank you for all the inspiration you've given us and, you know, just gracing us with your light and wisdom. It's just been so, so wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you. That's very kind. Really wonderful. I think I've a little bit run over.
No, that's fine. I just want to quickly mention to listeners about your new book, Wisdom is Bliss, Four Friendly Facts That Can Change Your Life. It's now available in all major bookstores and on your website, bobthurman.com.
And the subtitle, I really like the subtitle, Four Friendly Fun Facts.
Yes.
That can change your life.
Yeah.
And you know how I learned about a fun fact? You know how I learned that? It's a fun story. I don't think I wrote it in the book. But I have a friend who is the founder of the Hasbro Toy Company.
Okay.
And he and I were at a dinner. We were on a board of another nonprofit together trying to help out school children and things. And we had a dinner on the board. And to get to know each other, the sort of chair said, everyone should tell their own fun fact. And I'd never heard of a fun fact. I didn't know what that was. And then he said, okay, I'll do my fun. And I didn't know what to say. And then he did his fun fact. And his fun fact was that he's the executive chairman of the company he created, which he used to be the CEO of, right? He's elder, a little bit elder like me, younger than me, but a little bit elder. And so he said, but my fun fact is, he said, that being an executive chairman of a company is like presiding over a cemetery. There's a lot of people beneath you, but no one is listening. I feel like that. So that meant that he was having fun doing other things and he couldn't really worry about his company because it wouldn't do any good anyway. You know what I mean?
That's hilarious. So that's where...
I've told that to a lot of people. Everybody roars with laughter. So obviously, he was a successful toy company founder. You know? Has a good sense of humor. Alan did.
Anyway, right. And this book is... And you know, I could see how you kind of incorporated that into this book, because it's really easy to read, and it's conversational. You know, I found myself laughing at certain parts. Like, I felt like you were talking to me, which is something I always appreciate in a book, you know?
Thank you so much, Celine.
All right.
Celine Chenoy. I like the name. It's really wonderful.
Thank you. Robin, it's been an honor and a true pleasure speaking to you. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Well, it's been my honor and my pleasure. Okay.
Thank you.
I'll come back with the next book or any other time.
Absolutely. Of course. You're always welcome.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, please subscribe to my podcast and feel free to share it with your friends and family. Take care and speak soon.